Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
Are you thinking about starting your wealth-creating journey, but not sure where to put your hard-earned dollars? InvestSmart can help. InvestSmart offers a free quiz that makes it easy to find the right InvestSmart ETF portfolio to help you reach your goals. Just visit investsmart.com.au and hit Get Started. Answer a few simple questions about your goals and how much you want to invest, and you'll get a tailored statement of advice with a portfolio recommendation. You can visit investsmart.com.au for a no obligations free statement of advice. This ad is brought to you by InvestSmart Advice, AFSL 334107.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
Mitchell Snedden, welcome to the Australian Investors Podcast.
G'day, Owen. How you doing?
Good, mate. I'm pretty good. I should make a special note for our dear friend, Drew Meredith, who is not here today. He sent me a text message earlier on saying that he was just in New York City over there for a macroeconomics event and got hit by Jerome Powell's Cadillac. So he will be back next week, he believes, in fine spirits. But that's okay, mate, because today folks get to hear from you and I, and it's a bit of fun. It's your first time on the show. So why don't we do a bit of an intro to Mitch? Tell us a little bit about yourself, man.
Sure. I've just joined the RASC group, specifically on the RASC Invest side of things. The title we're rolling with is the Head of Funds Management. I've got about 15 years experience in the funds management industry, predominantly on the distribution and client services side of things. So I've headed up our client service teams before, looking after all different types of investors. I'm brand spanking new to RASC. Of course, I've actually been a listener of the Australian Investors Podcast for a long time. I've had a lot of fund managers on there that I know. Some mates of mine have been on there. I've known you for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. I even, at one point in time, worked alongside your colleague, Kate Campbell.
So that you're reunited.
We're reunited. Yeah, that's right. Kate can, we're reunited. Let's just say that.
So Kate may or may not be listening to this show, but g'day to Kate. You can hear more from her on the Australian Finance Podcast series. But you're officially in the role as our Head of Funds Management, which obviously just recently coincided with the launch of our RASC Invest service, which is where you're spending the predominant amount of your time, and you've been meeting with a lot of investors in the RASC community. So I'm just curious how you found that, and anything that's come up for you in the very short period of time that that you've been with us.
Yeah, it's only been a couple of days, but the RASC community was a really big driver for me to actually join. I actually reached out to Owen when RASC Invest launched and said, listen, I can see incredible value in the community that you've built, the trust that you've generated in this community over the years and years and years of doing these podcasts and live events, et cetera. And I think that, you know, you could really build something special here on the RASC Invest side of things. And our values align, our long-term vision of RASC Invest was aligned. And so, we got to work. And so I've been talking with a lot of our early adopters. So the RASC Invest super fans, people who put their hand up to be first in the door. And they are a mixed bag of people. They come from all walks of life. They all have one thing in common, though. They are all long-term, like-minded investors who, want to grow their wealth in the right way. Well, grow it slowly, well-diversified portfolios, And that makes sense because they've been listening to you for such a long time. They've kind of got that long-term mindset ingrained into them from all of your podcasts. So the younger people, they're really enthusiastic. They're, as I said, long-term focused, and they're really zeroing in on those on the regular contribution plans and things like that we have in place. So automating their savings to get the most out of their investment account. The older people that I've been talking to, they're predominantly SMSF investors. They've been running an SMSF for many, many years. And for a lot of them, they've been looking for someone who they can trust with the core component of their investments. They've been reading up a lot about ETFs over the last few years, and they've been coming around to them. So they've been going from, you know, doing their own stock picking and having portfolios heavy of the banks and the resource companies and a couple of telcos here in Australia, to broadening their horizons with simplifying their portfolios with international ETFs, Australian ETFs. And so they've been kind of wanting someone to be a bit of a guiding hand in them stepping away from the day-to-day running of their portfolio so they can get on and enjoy their retirement. I've been talking to a lot of people like that. So, and it's been great. Every single person has been super enthusiastic about what we're doing here. And it's a wonderful position to be in.
Yeah, bloody earth. And it's been a huge relief for you to come on board. I've probably spoke to about 30 or 40 of our investors and our really passionate fans in the RAS community. And it's been probably the highlight of my career the past month or two, just hearing from them and just chatting with them. I think the record, so I typically, as you know, would book in half an hour with folks, have a chat, but I think the record is about 4.5 hours is one of those conversations. And it's been so great just to hear people's journey to investing. And for everyone's benefit, a lot of people probably don't realize this, but we obviously know it. The RAS community is a lot older than people suspect. I think it's maybe because of the primary colors, the green, the blue, the yellow. It seems like it's the younger person's domain, but it's not really. Like, we don't really have that many people. Like, when I say that many, we have more people in their 70s, typically at our events, than in their 20s. So that puts it in perspective for people of like how much older the community is. And I'd say the lion's share, 75% or more, over 50 when they book these investor calls, which has been really cool.
Yeah, I think it's maybe the people who are active and engaging with you because they have a need for your service right now. They are that older cohort. I do think that there's people like me who are been avid listeners and were maybe not active on the path of maybe they are actually active on the path of building their wealth, but they're out there with their CommSec account or their Perla account or Self-Wealth or whatnot, and they're handpicking individual stocks and things like that. But the people who are actually actively reaching out to us have maybe been doing that for a long time and looking for someone they can trust to take on a bit of the bulk of that work. So I think you might be maybe underselling the average age of your audience there. Maybe, I don't know. I've not even seen the demographics.
But maybe we'll find out in the next few weeks as people come forward. You can actually book in a chat with Mitchell if you do want to. There's a link in the show notes if you want to learn more about RASC Invest and what we're building. We've kind of kept it under wraps quite heavily while we get many things ready behind the scenes, but it is the biggest move we've ever made at the RASC Group in terms of helping people by managing their money, whether it's an SMSF, a holding company, a kid's account, or an individual account or a joint account, whatever, we can handle it. Before we get into some of the news of the week, and we've got some companies here, I want to talk about Netwealth, NAB, and NextDC. You might be thinking, did he just go to the N category of the ASX this week? And the answer is no. I just went for some of the topical news stories, and Netwealth, NAB, and NextDC just happened to all start with N. I'm going to ask you for a few things because as I've got to know you this past week or so, mate, I've realized that you seem to be pretty... You've got your finger on the zeitgeist, the pulse of the restaurant scene, not just here in Melbourne, but around the trap. So I'm going to ask for your favorite coffee spot.
Favorite coffee spot? I would have to say, this is just purely geographical as well, because it's at the end of my street, but I happen to live...
Now you know where Mitch lives.
Yeah, I'll let you know. That's in the show notes too. No, at the end of my street, I've got Padre Coffee. Padre is fantastic. So I live in Brunswick. It's just down the road. And they do a really, really good cup of coffee. Also, I buy the Padre beans to grind at home. Saying that, I've just picked up some Market Lane beans as well. Their headquarters just happens to be across the road from daycare.
They've been a local shop.
They've got a little vending machine out the front of their headquarters, and you can go and pick your beans from the vending machine. So it's pretty handy. And they've got a cafe now on Sydney Road, which is like a really elevated coffee. So it's pretty.
Yeah, great. So anyone that isn't familiar, Brunswick is inner northern Melbourne, and it's a very multicultural area with lots of different fooderies and these types of things. So I'm going to actually transition there. And this doesn't have to necessarily be in Victoria, Melbourne, Australia. It doesn't have to be anywhere. But I'm just curious what your favorite restaurant is.
Just one?
Give us a few.
Okay, yeah, let's do that. I'm going to go with, me and a couple of mates really tried to go around and hit up a couple of digger stations a year at the various Haddad restaurants. The likes of the Lake House in Dalesford's fantastic and consistent. And then, you know, there's the Royal Mail at Dunkeld. But I'm going to say my favourites are the ones that I consistently go back to. And they would be, so I think one that flies under the radar here in Melbourne is Embla. We happened to go there yesterday, Alan.
Yes.
And if you're going to Embla, a hot tip, if it's just two of you, book a seat book a seat at the kitchen bar. So they cook everything over open flame. The oven's amazing. And if you book a seat at the kitchen bar, they're working right in front of you. And you get a front row view of the oven and everything. It's fantastic. Then venturing out my way, if you're in Brunswick East on Lygon Street, consistently good, great wine list by the glass and always changing the menu would be Old Palm Liquor. They are really, really good. Yeah.
Great. And if you're from a different state, I'd say the equivalent in probably Sydney, if you're in Surrey Hills or something like that, to Embla might be something like Polly, P-O-L-Y, if you haven't already been there.
Yeah.
They cook over an open flame, lots of fresh ingredients too. It's wonderful.
So. I think as well in Sydney, it'd be Fyadil. Would be pretty similar as well.
Yep. So there's lots, and I'm sure if you've got some good tips for us around Brisbane, Perth, these types of things, we will be coming around to you this year. So in the second half of this year, we're likely to go on the road again, and we would love some suggestions because as you can probably tell, Mitch and I are into that sort of a thing. One final question for you before we move on to the news of the week, mate, which is in a previous life, you did spend a lot of time interviewing the who's who of Australian finance, speaking to investors of all stripes, strategies, frameworks, and kinds, and you name it, you spoke to them. So being behind a camera like this or on audio is not a relatively new thing to you. You've done it many times before over many years. So I'm curious, in terms of people that you've interviewed or people that you've spoken to, my question is, what's your favorite interview of all time?
So I had to think about this. I've got a few favorite people. So in a past life, I worked with at Eureka Report with Alan Kohler, and I did a lot of live interviews with fund managers and then a lot of pre-recorded ones and whatnot as well. So, I mean, I absolutely, some of my favorites just because they're lovely people, the likes of David Kirk from Baylor, that's a listed investment company focusing on tech, BTI is the stock code. Mm-hmm. He's just a really lovely guy. From BKI, Tom Milner and Will Colbert are always got a lot of time for them. They're really nice people. But when you asked me this question before, one interview really, really stood out. Because he's quite a character, mm-hmm. and two, because of the circumstances that unfolded shortly after. Okay. So I interviewed many, many moons ago, Peter Hall. From the founder of Hunter Hall Funds Management. They had, you know, a number of really, really high performing managed funds. They had a couple of listed investment companies. And Peter Hall was he was a fun guy. Like he just got a larger than life character. And we were having a really good chat, and he's got a wonderful laugh on him. And it was just really amusing. Fast forward 2 weeks from that interview, and next minute, Hunter Hall, their fund's performance had just collapsed. They'd had a few, because they ran a couple of concentrated investment funds. And they fell on hard times. Peter Hall went to do basically a fire sale of the Hunter Hall business. It's a listed company as well. And he was going to sell his stake, I think it was to Soul Patts, for a huge discount. And then I think they ended up selling to Pengana, I think, right. Eventually. This is a while ago. And then I just happened to have previously worked with the then chairman at Hunter Hall, Paul Jensen. So I gave Paul a quick text. He couldn't remember me. And I gave him a quick text, and I got him and the new chief investment officer had stepped up from underneath Peter to come in and actually tell their side of the story like 2 weeks later. Mm-hmm. So it was, it was memorable. One, because Peter's a real character. Two, because he did a fire sale of Hunter Hall and then flew it, buggered off over to the UK. And three, I could wrap it up neatly with a follow-up interview with the people who were there picking up the pieces. Yeah.
It's quite a story for anyone that isn't familiar. I'd encourage you to go back and just do some searching for Hunter Hall and some of the news stories that were at the time. It was a classic drama in Australian financial circles, and it was definitely the biggest thing going on at the time. Well, Mitch, I know you've got a few stories to tell, but we may as well move on to the news of the week, which was we've got a few different news snippets that we pulled from the ASX. I'll probably start with the least interesting one, which you described as potentially being the rearranging of deck chairs on the Titanic.
No, I wasn't. That was just off the cuff. I did say, well, we're talking about the new leadership team at NAP. It wasn't deck chairs on the Titanic. I have a question. I've heard a lot of investors question, are these really, really large institutions? Are these leadership teams more caretakers? Mm-hmm. Like you kind of bring someone on board and their job is not to stuff it up.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is fair enough. And so just for a bit of context, NAB has appointed a new boss, a new CEO, and brought in a new leadership team alongside. And the reality is, I agree with you, mate, that a lot of these big businesses, it is a bit like steering the Titanic in that, my words, not yours, in that the important point is that a lot of these businesses basically just have to keep the ship running. And particularly a highly regulated business like NAB or Westpac or CBA, a lot of their business is actually half politician, half business person. And if you've track the comments of any of the big CEOs over time, that's basically the kind of scrutiny they get, is equivalent to like any idea they have is both good and bad. It's never like a founder from the United States might come out with some great product or service and it's really innovative, typically well received. Once you get to a mature phase in your business cycle, it changes kind of the how you operate that business and what actually happens. And these businesses are definitely like that. I think NAB's revival following the GFC, it's been quite impressive. It's now the second largest bank behind CBA. You go back a few years, that was Westpac. I think of the four, Westpac is very disappointing. I'd say ANZ is also equally very disappointing, but NAB did have that title probably from the 2008 through to 2014 and has since really cleaned itself up. It's now Australia's premier business bank alongside CBA. Interestingly, we did have Joseph Healy on the show, the co-founder and CEO of Judo Bank on the RAS network last year. And it was a really interesting conversation about how the industry may be evolving on the business banking side. It's been an industry that has been very stale for decades and decades and decades. But NAB's new structure is very, very clean compared to what it was where it had Clydesdale and Yorkshire Bank. You might remember that one, mate. And it had a lot of bad debts in the GFC. Basically, it leveraged itself up in the UK and right around the world, and it was left with so much debt, and a lot of that was against assets that were overvalued. and was since bundled up and then shoveled off to investment banks and the like over a number of years. So it's finally through that period, and share price kind of reflects that success, which has been really good. It's also paid very, very handy dividends along the way. So a new leadership team, I mean, at the end of the day, I think what a lot of investors underestimate, Mitch, I don't know if you have a view on this, but what a lot of investors do underestimate is it's not just about having the title, it's also about having the authority. And a lot of CEOs that you might meet don't have a significant shareholding in the business they run. And it's really important to understand this, is because you might be the CEO, but you are responsible to the board, and the board can fire you at any moment. And at the end of the day, unless you have a significant shareholding, you don't have much influence on what actually gets done in that business. And so that's why people probably miss the key point of a founder is a great business. Typically, on average, you want to invest with founders or families. And that's fair to say, but it's not just because they are visionaries and these types of things. It's also because when things go wrong, they can't get booted out because they own so much of the company. And so it's a double-edged sword. You could have some crazy founder and significant shareholder who really is crazy and not for the right reasons. But the reality is, like, a good example of this would say be like Richard White from WiseTech, which is the software business for logistics companies. He owns a mountain of shares in that company. And there was a time when WiseTech strategy was seriously put under the microscope with the short seller reports and these types of things.
Yeah, they had the interview on the ABC team. And
people, you know, shareholders were probably rightly concerned, right? And it sounded like the narrative was they're not accounting for things properly. Maybe there's something dodgy going on underneath the surface. And he just basically came out and said that's not, you know, true because of X, Y, and Z reasons. But at the time, if he didn't own a significant number of shares, if he wasn't the founder, for example, it could have been a case where the board had to make a decision because they were facing so much pressure. And so when you get businesses where they are significantly owned internally and those people have executive positions, that's where you kind of get the full impact of a founder or family-run business.
And you get the stability to execute a long-term plan.
Exactly. Otherwise, the stock market is myopic. Like, most people who talk about the stock market that aren't really involved with it are typically talking about yesterday's share prices or what the ASX 200 did on the news and these types of things. And then if you go one step further, most analysts and brokers are talking about what's happened in the most recent 3-month period. And if you go one step further, financial advisors can't sit there in front of clients again and again and again if one of their managed funds is down 20% over the last year and justify why that client would still be holding that. They'd lose their job, right? So the whole system is myopic. And literally the only thing that can withstand that is a significant shareholding by a founder or family. And a beautiful example of that is what you mentioned before, which is Soul Patts with the Milner family. They have faced intense scrutiny over decades to break that thing up, and they've kept it together. We've actually got a question on that in a minute. So when you see these leadership changes at big businesses, to wrap this up, there's so much more to it than just who's coming in and what strategy they have. It's knowing who could influence that business and in what ways. The other piece of news that we saw this week was from NextDC, ASX ticker symbol NXT. Most people would know this business for the founder and who's involved with it, but NextDC is a business that's often been called the real estate investment trust or the REIT of cloud computing. So basically, if you have familiarity with the cloud, like Amazon AWS, Google GCP, Microsoft Azure, even Alibaba's network, you know, all of these different cloud providers. Where those actual computers sit is in a data center, and NextDC, being Next Data Center, that's where the name comes from, they basically build and maintain those sites, and they're all across Australia. Here in Melbourne, if you go on the Balti Bridge back towards the CBD, you'll see one just down on your left-hand side as you cross the bridge, and you'll see them all across the country, typically close to major cities because that's where the bandwidth to get from you on your device and walking down George Street in Sydney and you've got your phone, you want a quick connection. Well, that's why they're located so close to the city. And so basically the business's job is to buy the real estate, set up the centers, maintain them for capacity, not just now and into the future. The reason why NextDC was in the news this week is it's raising $1.3 billion as part of a renounceable rights issue, which is a huge amount of money, Mitch, for the Australian market. Like, it's a massive amount of money.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's
And the business is going to effectively spend that on upgrading existing facilities, but also new facilities. We've looked at NEXTDC many times over the years for our investment services. And my concern has always been that it's quite a competitive market. NEXTDC is really moving ahead. But the business, to put it in context, in this year ahead, it's expecting total revenue to be in the range of $400 million to $415 million. So it is in this intense phase of capital expenditure where it's taking all this money and it is investing it. And this isn't the first time that NEXTDC has raised capital. It's not a capital light business, which is one of the reasons that it puts me off. But some people do see it as basically a future infrastructure play in their portfolios.
Yeah, that makes sense that they need to continually do these upgrades and whatnot to keep up. It's like any old infrastructure asset, like the maintenance is required on toll roads, airports, et cetera, et cetera. So, it's not a capital light business.
No, but it does enable capital light businesses. So behind the scenes, I would preferably, the next business we're going to talk about is probably one of the three that I'd pick if I was to own one of these businesses. But NEXTDC is a good business. I just don't think it's the type of business that I want to own longer term. I think if I have a core and a satellite part of my portfolio, as you know, the core's ETFs predominantly, the satellite component, I want to basically shoot for the stars in terms of the types of businesses that I want to own. I want to be really picky or choosy. And for me, this is a business that I've struggled to comprehend about when it reaches that inflection point in profitability, when and how that will happen in terms of the sustainability of those margins. I just don't have a strong view, so I can't get conviction in that. But NEXTDC is raising money and it's doing it in a way which I strongly agree with. And I'll explain what it is. It's a fully underwritten 1-for-6 pro rata accelerated non-renounceable entitlement offer.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah. For folks who don't know what that means, basically it's doing a capital raising, but it's giving existing shareholders the ability to buy 1-for-6, meaning for every 6 you currently own, you get the offer to buy 1. And it's at a discounted share price to what it was before the announcement was made. Now, The reason that it's interesting is that it has a non-renounceable entitlement offer, meaning that you basically can't give it up. Sometimes firms will allow you to give it up. The other thing is that makes it interesting is it's fully underwritten. So it's basically not guessing. It's saying, if you don't take up your entitlement, we have someone to underwrite this, like an investment bank or a broker who will buy all of the shares. So if you don't take up your offer, you will be slightly diluted, meaning, you know, you might own 0.001%. Now it's 0.005 or 0.05% or something like that, you know, a tiny bit of dilution. But that's basically the way they work. I have a preference for renounceable entitlement offers where people can trade away their rights or at least benefit from it. So that's that one. Final piece of news before we get into questions, Mitch, comes from Netwell, ASX ticker symbol NWL, one of the real top performers on the ASX over the past decade. It's run by the Heiner family.
Yeah, another founder-led business there.
Yeah. So Netwell, and I know you're familiar with this business overall and the products and services, came out with its quarterly business update for the March quarter of 2024. And if you were to tell me that a business that's already at scale, Midge, achieved 30% growth year over year, would you say that's good?
Yeah, that's pretty good. So they will, of course, benefit from the growth in share markets as well, because that'll grow their assets under management. And additionally, I believe these platform companies, Netwealth, Hub, et cetera, also benefit from increasing interest rates.
Yes.
Because they do clip the ticket or cash in bank from those various accounts that they have.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what these platforms are, you mentioned Hub24 is probably the other one that's the big contender, but they provide a software platform that'll for financial advisors to administer their clients' portfolios. So say, for example, Mitch is your financial advisor. You go to Mitch. Mitch goes, okay, Mr. Smith, we're going to put you and your superannuation, your SMSF, onto the NetWealth platform. They're going to charge me 0.2% a year, 0.3% a year. You have to pay that because you're the client, not me. It's not my money. But that's going to help us, and we're going to simplify your tax. We're going to be able to invest from that account and so on and so forth. And so this is one of those wonderful businesses that basically makes money from customers who don't know exactly what they're getting. And what I mean by that is it sits in the middle of the financial advisor who recommends the service to a client who pays the bill. It's kind of like Xero, how most small businesses don't know exactly what the Xero business is day to day. They know roughly it does their accounting and stuff for them. But the reality is they don't pay for Xero. Their accountant does, and their accountant passes the fee on normally with a little clip of the ticket. It's similar to the Burson business, the auto parts business. A mechanic recommends that you need these particular repairs to your car, and Burson goes and buys those parts and then delivers them to the mechanic on your behalf. And these are wonderful business models, because typically what happens in a business-to-business relationship is it's not as price sensitive as it is for a consumer-facing business. So that's one of the key distinctions here. And you're right, NetWealth makes a lot of money, not just from the admin fees that it charges. It also manages some of the money now. It also can clip the ticket on any cash that sits in its platform, because that cash has to sit somewhere, and it can clip the ticket, similar to Computershare, if people are familiar with that business. And NetWealth overall reported total FUA, or funds under administration, up 28%, thanks to things like the stock market going up, but also very strong flows. It had $2.7 billion of new money added to the platform, which was up 62%.
Is that them taking market share from the incumbents, like your BT Panoramas and your Macquarie Wraps?
So it's more so from the big banks. This transition is still underway. Actually, Macquarie's platform, they also, Macquarie Bank, also have their own platform. And that is probably the number one competitor to Hub and NetWealth in terms of their disruption. Like, Macquarie's platform is also growing very fast. And that's because the traditional incumbents, which were the big banks in this space, did a really poor job of servicing their clients. And these new age tech platforms have started to eat into that in a big way. There's also IOOF and others in this space, but it's Macquarie. In my opinion, it's Macquarie, NetWealth, and Hub that are leading this charge. They mentioned a few things in their quarterly update around, you know, making the use of generative AI and these types of tools. Obviously, that will help any technology business. I went back this week and listened to the Alphabet or Google quarterly conference call. I just love to tune into those big tech company quarterly calls every now and again. And you don't need to listen for too long before AI is brought up, before LLMs are brought up, before, you know, all of these assistants are brought up. And the reality is that they are going to drastically change the way software is built and the way not just financial advisors in this instance, but imagine clients of these platforms kind of interacting with the software. I'll give you an example, Mitch. I'm speaking at an upcoming Stockbrokers Association conference in Melbourne, and my panel, which is a great panel, has someone from Hub on there, and it also has other financial professionals. And our topic is the future of wealth management. And it's really interesting to hear such a diverse range of perspectives and how everyone thinks different AI tools, different software can solve a lot of the industry's problems and help investors invest better. But NetWealth is definitely at the forefront of that. It has a price earnings ratio over 63 times, which for most traditional value investors is a scary, scary figure. Is it too high? I don't know. I think that it's always been an expensive business. At $19 a share, is it expensive? Well, it probably is a little bit exy, but it's always been expensive because it's a high quality business. Dividend yield of 1.4%. So not why you'd be buying this company. Family run. I think it's a really, really impressive business. And if you have a view to buy it now, you'd have to be aiming for that company to be in your portfolio for 5+ years, maybe 10 years. And a lot can change in that time. So maybe for a very small position of portfolio, you could have it. It's one of the highest quality companies in Australia on the stock exchange. Doesn't, you know, faces a lot of competition. You could take a Hub plus NetWealth, not a Hub or NetWealth type approach to this. A lot of the competitors or adjacent businesses like Class and those types of businesses have been bought out.
Yeah, so, Class is owned by Hub.
Yeah. So the industry is also accelerating in terms of its consolidation. So we do have a few big stalwarts now with NetWealth, Harvard, Macquarie. I think the whole industry will benefit from the technology that's about to be rolled out throughout every walk of life. But a lot can change. I would just say maybe a small position of portfolio, not a big one at this stage. So mate, we've got time for some questions. Now, we have picked out a few that were sent in advance. So maybe I'll defer to you to ask the questions. But before we get to the answers, I will give the disclaimer once again, which is that you can send your questions in by the link in the show notes. We don't know your personal needs, goals, or objectives, so we cannot offer any type of personalized financial advice over a podcast such as this one. You will have to seek the advice of a financial planner, and you can find one of those by heading to the link in your show notes. It says financial planning. You just click that one. If you do want to send a question in, send it in via the link in your show notes that says ask a question and select the Australian Investors Podcast. Dr. Andrew Derrimuth or Drew Meredith and myself love to receive your questions, so please keep them coming in. We're getting them thick and fast these days. Mitch, that's my disclaimer done.
All right, let's get into it. Dr. Freebook says, picking up on your discussion, Re-Sol, you mentioned that dividends were a good guide to performance rather than earnings per share. Is this typical for all LICs? I'll just quickly say that Solpats is not an LIC. It's despite, I mean, you could look at it like that. It's a listed investment company. But I would say regarding a performance measurement of LICs, the NTA growth is a good indication. But also, if you're earning and profitable, you can of course then pay great dividends. I know Solpats do have a relatively high payout ratio, so check out the payout ratio with LICs. They do also have something that they call a profit reserve, and that's where they're able to reserve profits from previous years, and so they can smooth out their dividends going forward. Like AFIC and Argo make relatively good use of that. Most of them break it out in their annual reports, so check that out next time you're looking at them. I have heard the Solpats are really, really, really focused on dividends. I know Milner Senior, he's got a great quote, the thicker the carpet, the thinner the dividend.
I love that.
Yeah, I've heard him say that in a few. He's got lots of good quotes. He's once said to me that he would walk around the car park of a company that he was going to inspect, and he would see if the executives and the management team were driving two flasher cars. That was a red flag to him. Essentially, when it comes to businesses like Solpats and whatnot, absolutely earnings with their dividend, but check out with LICs, the profit reserves, and then as well the payout ratios.
Yeah, I like it. And for those people who are just catching up with Mitch's background, he spent a lot of time diving into the weeds of listed investment companies or LICs and ETFs. He spent a lot of time talking about them publicly for people as well. So hence the depth of knowledge there. It is important to understand that Solpats is not a listed investment company in a traditional sense, although it is listed on the stock exchange and invests in other companies. So it kind of gets confusing for people. A quintessential or a perfect example of a LIC, a listed investment company, is AFIC and Argo, or even the Wilson Asset Management, the WAM list of companies, which started with WAM Capital back in the day. Those are listed investment companies. And as Mitch referred to, the NTA, the net tangible assets, this is basically the assets that sit inside the management company, like what's actually being managed. And you can compare that to the share price. Now, you'll find that if you look at basically every LIC, there are some exceptions. They all trade at a discount to their NTA. What that basically means is the share price is below the level of the value of assets inside of that thing. Be careful of when you're measuring both of those things, but that's pretty common. With something like Solpats, a key distinction is that it's a business that is set up to run as a business rather than a listed investment company which just invests in other companies. So Solpats, in this instance, started as pharmacies. People will remember over 100 years ago, it started as two pharmacies coming together, and it's since grown and morphed into something wonderful. and it owns businesses, but it can also operate them. It has a bunch of private companies that it may not be hands-on day-to-day like the Soul Patts team. It may be a different company, but they own it in its entirety and then can sell it separately or hold it for forever. And that's what makes it so special. So in terms of how do you look at it, I would say at any lick, you would do what Mitch says, the NTA, just being realistic and looking at that and also looking at the investment management agreement. That's the thing that is in the background, allows that listed investment company and the investment team to keep managing that portfolio.
And charge a fee. Let's not forget those. So most LICs these days are known as what's known as externally managed. So they'll be the investment company and then they'll have a management agreement. And that allows them to charge 1% plus performance or whatever they like. The difference between, say, an AFIC and an Argo, these the old school ones, is they are internally managed. And that's why their fees are a lot lower. So yeah, that's a big point of difference when checking.
Yeah, good point. And they're different to an ETF, just for anyone's benefit, in that they are a company. They're not a trust underneath, which does have differences, similarities and differences, good and bad, potentially in some ways. But the majority of our portfolios are built out of ETFs because variance in the ease of use. Not to say that LICs would never be in there, but it's a type of investment typically what I'd be going for with a LIC versus an ETF. And keeping in mind with Soul Patts, one of the extra things that they have to do, rather than a traditional company, if you look at their financial statements, you'll probably see something like net profit down 200%, and then they'll have normalized profit up 3% or something like that. You'll see very different profit figures. And that's because of the way the accounting works for a company like Soul Patts and the way it has to basically account for the differences in valuations of the businesses inside of it. That's why I say look at the dividends, because the dividends are a more consistent guide to what's actually happening inside the business, not the profit per share or earnings per share. So that was a good question.
Yeah. On to the next one. And this is not really a question, as Lucy here points out. She says, not a question. Loving the new State of the Market series. Please continue.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Lucy. That's with the Honourable Pete Wargent, who is the co-host of our Australian Property Podcast, but also our investment consultant for Rask Invest, and he and I are going to do those quarterly State of the Market series, where it's basically a full hour of going through all the major asset classes, property, shares, bonds, you name it. We're going to go through it all to give you a pretty clear picture of what's actually transpired every single 3-month period across the world and as they relate to investors. So Lucy, thanks for that feedback. We love feedback. Keep it coming. Not a question, but you get a copy of Drew's book, which is The Golden Years, something about retirement, but it's a wonderful book, and you can get it mailed to you. You just need to send us your address via email. Mitch, what's up next?
All right, next one. From It's a Cruel World. Love the podcast. Been listening for almost a year. Fantastic. Welcome. I'm in my mid-30s and quite active with my investing. I wanted to ask your thoughts on the future of superannuation in Australia and what scenarios may play out over the next 30 years. Before I get access to my soup.
Yep.
Do you think we are heading toward tighter restrictions for assessing funds in the future? And do you think we would ever switch to an annuity-based system?
I'm not 100% sure about the annuity-based system, because we did have something similar to that. If you go back maybe 2 decades, we did have what we call defined benefit plans. They're still in existence today. And if you have one, congrats to you, because they're amazing. But typically what we have in Australia is a contribution system. So what happens is when you hit retirement, you benefit from the value of your portfolio, whatever level it is. Whereas in the past, companies would offer their employees something called a defined benefit plan. And governments could do this as well. And effectively what they would do is when you get to the retirement age, they would guarantee a salary for forever, which is when you think about the maths in that and you think about the responsibility of that company being viable as you approach retirement, that's a huge financial responsibility to guarantee for someone into the future.
And that was especially now that people are living longer as well.
Absolutely. So the system got put under huge financial pressure. If you go and you look at, say, like the state of or the city of Detroit in America, you will see that state basically collapsed. And a big part of the reason is they had a lot of these types of pension plans and they just couldn't keep up. Like the auto industry basically pivoted and started to go broke at the same time as the value of those pension plans were going up because people were living longer, inflation was ticking over, and so on and so forth. So what basically happened in place of that is we started with these contribution strategies where we commit 9.5 or 10% of our super at the moment through our employer, but we could also top up our super. Now that's got so big and so good that now the government wants to put caps in place on how much we should have in there when we transition to retirement, how much we should be able to draw out and these types of things. And this is a better model because it does mean that you are contributing to your own future, not the company guaranteeing you something that they might never be able to fulfill on. But what basically happened is there's these other things which emerged in between to try and fill the gap, which is called an annuity. And the biggest provider of annuities in Australia is a company called Challenger. Challenger trades under the ticker symbol on the ASX. It's a publicly listed company, CGF. And Challenger basically stepped in to say, hey, we can take that money from you or a certain amount of your money, and we can provide you with an annuity. So effectively, you give us $500,000 and we will guarantee a certain amount of income. And you might be thinking, well, how does Challenger do that? It effectively takes that money and just invests it. It'll invest it into bonds, shares, all these types of things, and pay you a regular income stream. And so people like financial planners or even individual investors who don't have the confidence to build their own portfolio and manage that effectively, they're a pretty good option. You know, they're a pretty good option. But ultimately, I think what we will see is, well, we've already kind of seen it, is the government basically, when they started the current superannuation system, is they basically said, here are the goalposts, go and kick as many goals as you like. Like, it's a training exercise, just go and put all your money in, it's pretty loose, just go and have some fun. Now they said, okay, now, well, here's now the boundary. You can't go outside of this if you're going to try and kick a goal, you have to stick in this range. And now they're saying, all right, now the goals are a little bit narrower and you can only kick from this direction at this time. And it will only, you can only kick so many goals before you won't be able to kick through them anymore. And that's basically where we're at now, is the goalposts have become so narrow that you can only have a certain amount in super, and everyone's got to get up to that limit and then look at other options. Like, you have to go and, you know, go to another sporting code, if you like. And so
I'm looking forward to this analogy getting more complex. Please keep going, Owen.
But basically, we've got to a point now where there is a balance transfer cap, and people have now realized that they have to, if they're on the higher end of that range, they have to look at other options. And so for anyone that's younger, this is pretty, the writing has been on the wall for a couple of decades that the government was going to do this. It was a honeypot that was too good for them not to play around with and dip their fingers into. So we've seen that. For younger people, what we might see and what Drew alluded to last week, and we've had Dr. Cameron Murray on our other podcast, and we've had other people speak about this across the RAS network, is we might see people being able to access super earlier for different reasons. And so, for example, people may be able to use it to buy a first home in a pretty limited way. We've already had that with the First Home Super Saver Scheme, which is currently in effect. But I think that's what people will start to see as more political pressure gets put on people and regulators to make that change. Does that mean it's a good idea? I think the jury's still out.
I was going to say, do you think that's a great idea? I certainly don't want to go down the path right now of the housing debate. We don't want to get into that.
First podcast episode for you, man.
Yeah, let's not do that. You know, you see during COVID, for example, the government allowing people to dip the super to draw out that 10 or 20 grand, whatever it was, to support themselves during that. And I'm not sure that's the best.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. If you think about the purpose of super was to fund retirement.
And not the purchase of a house.
Yes. However, the counterpoint or the nuance here is that typically people that are in retirement that have their own home do feel more secure and do feel more, and they are statistically more financially stable. So it would beg the question then, why shouldn't we be able to use super as a vehicle to set ourselves up in that way? And I would agree with that. Why shouldn't we? But I also just think that we're pretty narrow focus in here in Australia in terms of what assets we spend a lot of money on. And allowing people to do that would not help the housing crisis in any way. It would just push up prices ridiculously. Like, we've seen something from South Australia this week suggesting that they should double the first home owners grant. And anyone with, you know, who can fog a mirror would know that if you did that, it would just push up prices to the level of which the increase came. and it would just make it more unaffordable for the next generation, the next generation. So does that solve the housing crisis? Absolutely not. Is it a valid argument? Probably. And what are the takeaways for individual who are thinking of building inside super? Is you would do both. It's pretty clear you would try and do both. You wouldn't commit all your eggs to super because the rules will almost certainly change. So you would build wealth inside and outside of super. And that's what we're seeing from a lot of people that are talking to us is they are doing that. They might have closer to retirement. They're looking to maximize those super contributions. But in the lead up, they're still contributing, just not making absolute use of those because they know that they want more flexibility. And I think that's the best outcome for most people.
But we'll go to the last question here. The names, this is from the names bond, why bonds? Okay, so my question is about fixed income. Drew has recently mentioned government bonds yielding 4 to 5%. But when looking at bond ETFs, they seem to be yielding a lot less than that. Unlike institutional investors, we retail investors are limited in how we can access bonds and usually have to use things like bond ETFs to gain access to this asset class. As of today, long-winded question here. As of today, most of the bond ETFs such as VBND, IAF, and VAS are yielding around 2%. This puts the yield from bonds, bond funds lower than the cash rate and lower than inflation. With term deposits and high interest savings accounts currently yielding around 5%, are there any benefits to investing in bond ETFs?
And I would say the answer is absolutely.
Well, you've been looking at a lot of bond ETFs currently, Owen, because of the diversification requirements in our core portfolios.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I was just bringing up something as you were reading that off, and it's a great question. So we made a decision with our bond portfolios that we would start off with what we call long duration, so government bonds typically, and long dated government bonds. Just think about it like that because they're more sensitive. If interest rates come down, the long dated bonds are more likely to go up to a greater extent than, say, floating rate bonds, which are reset typically like every month or every quarter or something like that. So what you can do as an individual investor is you don't have to go all government bonds, which are yielding anywhere between 3 and say 5%. So this full disclosure, this podcast is sponsored by GlobalX. Their tagline is go beyond ordinary, I think. But anyway, besides me trying to riff that, they do have an ETF called USTB, which is the US Treasury Bond ETF and it's currency hedge. And this is an example of how you can invest in bonds or fixed income more precisely. You can invest in fixed income and you can get a yield that's quite respectable. Now, if we go to another extent, you and I caught up with VanEck this week, which is another one of the big ETF providers in the country. And they own and they issue an ETF called SUBD. S-U-B-D is the ticker symbol, the VanEck Australian Subordinated Debt ETF. So for people that invest in hybrids, this is probably something that's familiar to them. And so this ETF has a running yield of 6%. So that's significantly more than the Australian government bond ETFs. It's more than the US Treasury ETFs that I just mentioned. But you're not getting a traditional government bond. You're getting a different type of issuer in this. You're getting a credit exposure, what we call credit, not a government bond ETF. And so inside this ETF, you get things like Commonwealth Bank, National Australia Bank, Westpac, and all of these banks that are issuing different types of credit. So that they can, QBEs in there, what else have we got in there? HSBC, these types of issuers of debt, right? Because they use debt to fund their banks and these types of things. And so you can get a 6% yield from something like that. And if you think about it, Mitch, this is the first time in probably 10 or 15 years where the defensive side of a portfolio, the bonds, the credit, the term deposit, cash, the returns for income purposes is exceptional. So this sub-D ETF from VanEck has returned 7% over the past year. Where are the returns? It's returned 7% over the past year. Of that 7% return, 5.75% has come from the income. It's only gone up 1.3%. So this gives you a fantastic look at how this side of your portfolio can really add value. It pays a dividend every month. That's what you can expect from that side of the portfolio. So if you're if you're a retiree or someone who just has money, so you're not in debt and these types of things, like to an extent, this is probably the greatest time of your financial life of the past 15 or 20 years. Like, I'm not joking when I say that. Your house prices are up, your US stocks are up, your Australian stocks are up, your bonds are earning something, your term deposit's earning something, your cash account is paying you a wicked amount of interest. There's really nothing else. The superannuation's up. There's really nothing else that could be going in your favor any more than it already is.
Well, maybe the skeptic in me is a bit stronger than maybe other people, but is that a red flag to you?
Well, like whenever something's too good to be true, Alan. Well, if you think about this, let's go back to, say, the GFC, 2007. Stocks were just going ballistic. Obviously, everyone was getting high on those CDOs and there were some weird things happening in financial markets, and the markets were basically propped up by this really unusual debt thing that was a derivative and in the background, and people thought it was real, but it turns out it wasn't real and whatever. So interest rates were high then as well. You could get about 7% on your term deposit. Stocks were high. So bonds were yielding pretty well. And at the time, you'd be like, geez, everything's great right now. My property's gone through the roof. There's, you know, the Big Short movie, Mitch. People are buying houses in Florida. They have 10 houses. They don't actually know how they're funded and whatever. But it's not, as far as I can tell, it's not really like that. As in, I haven't seen any pockets of excess that would make
rampant speculation.
Exactly. However, there is obviously always risk. Like the US stock market is pretty highly valued. In Australia, we obviously have a cost of living crisis, and that can drastically affect the underlying profitability of businesses, which then leads to unemployment, which then leads to a lot of the kind of system not functioning at its fullest potential, which means that eventually interest rates will fall. And so the question that anyone that is in the situation, the fortunate situation of having a diversified portfolio, is thinking, well, if the inner skeptic does come out, Mitch, how can you position for that right now? And if my inner skeptic comes out, what it's telling me is that you shouldn't have all of your portfolio just in the floating rate bonds, which I mentioned were like the sub D, the treasury notes from GlobalX, those types of things. And you shouldn't have all of it necessarily just in government bonds. And you shouldn't have all of it just in Aussie or US stock. You should just be diversified. And if you have bonds and you have some cash, particularly government bonds, what you can do is that if something does go haywire in the economy, the natural reaction of any central bank is to cut interest rates to stimulate the economy. And what does that do? Well, that lifts the value of your bonds. And if you lock in some of your term deposits, but not all of them, you're going to maintain your purchasing power. That will make the value of your bonds go up and probably the value of your shares come down, or at least moderate if there's some sort of turbulence in the economy. And that is the beautiful thing about bonds, is as that happens, if you have a strategy that is set in advance and you can clearly think about this, you will know that, hang on a second, yeah, things have just turned pretty bad for the economy, but I've got my bonds and they've gone up. And I've got my cash, which is stable. The stock side of my portfolio struggled a little bit. So what do? Well, I rebalance. I take the things that have done well recently, the bonds in it, and I rebalance into shares and other asset classes that would seem a little bit cheaper all of a sudden. And that is the perfect reason why people who have balanced portfolios get ahead and people who don't fall behind.
Well, that rebalancing thing is naturally, as stock markets pull back, they're going to become lesser percentage of your portfolio, and that cash and bonds are going to increase in percentage. So if you want to maintain your balance, you are naturally being forced to tip out of one for the other.
Absolutely. And that's a natural rebalancing cycle. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why people who have a rebalancing rule tend to do better, because they have a plan in advance that when something happens, I am going to do it. If X happens, I'm going to do Y. And the reason why you do that in advance is because when things do get scary, you won't do it if you don't have a rule. So you set that rule in advance. And just by having that rule, it gives you confidence to make the choice, to make the decision when things go wrong.
And that's not market timing either. We don't advocate market timing. That is rebalancing as per the rules. The framework that you've set out, that mandate for your own portfolio, or for, you know, don't mind another plug, the RASC Invest portfolios. That's a framework that you set out in advance, so it's not.
Yeah, and a lot of people think that rebalancing is something that happens when. It's not really something that happens when, it's something that happens if. So what I mean by that is that it's not like I'm going to rebalance every 3 months. Why would you if things are foreign? You would do it when things have gone wrong. So it would be the if. If things go wrong, now I'm going to rebalance. If my stocks go way up and my bonds fall, I'm going to rebalance. If my bonds hold steady or become a bigger percentage of my portfolio, then I'll rebalance. And that's, as you said, it's not market timing. It's just that you've set a rule that you know, based on your research and history, what probably is going to happen. You don't know for sure. You have no idea for sure what's going to happen. But you know, statistically or in the past or whatever, this is what's likely to happen. And as a result, my rule is to do Y at that time. And this could be as simple for anyone that doesn't have a financial advisor or doesn't invest with someone else. It could be as simple as just writing some things down on a piece of paper. Quite a few years ago for our members, Mitch, we gave away something called a DIY investment plan. And it was basically, you know, what is my investment strategy? How will I manage my tax? When will I rebalance? And what rules will I give myself? Like, I won't own more than 10 ETFs and I won't own more than 20 stocks in my satellite. And I'm going to hold all of my shares in this broker account and on for all of my ETFs in that one. I'm going to use this tax reporting software. And you just write these things down. It doesn't have to be long. It can be one page on a Google Doc or...
Yeah, it's making a commitment to yourself.
Absolutely. And it protects your future self from making really bad decisions. So that's it, Mitch. That's it. And it's a great question. There's a series of great questions. Even Lucy's feedback is not a question, she said, but it's wonderful feedback. You've also given us some restaurants to try if folks are in Melbourne. We do have to select the best question to name of this week. And I do like the names Bonds, Why Bonds? So if you did ask that question, you do win a pass to the Value Investor Program. Everyone who wrote in this week, please send us your mailing address because Drew's book did come out 2 days ago. So you can send in your address if you did get your question on the show and we will send it out to you. Keith, I know you asked a couple of questions. You jumped into the community and said, hey, where's my book? Just send us your address, Keith, and we will post that out to you. There's hundreds of copies in the Wattle Partners office. So you can get your copy sent to you. And for anyone that wants to get in contact with Mitch or myself or learn more about Rask Invest, you can do that. There is a link in your show notes that says book a call with Mitch. You can chat with Mitchell or myself anytime you like. Just jump in there, reserve a time, and we'll be in contact with you. But Mitch, this is heaps of fun, mate. Congrats on your first appearance on the Australian Investors Podcast. It's been an absolute delight.
Thanks, Alan. You made it easy on me.
I hope so. But you're a natural talent, mate. So I really appreciate your time.
Settle down.
Bye for now.
Bye.
For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called Rask Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. Rask Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. Rask Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the Rask Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.